May it please the court. My name is Sarah Copeland, and I represent the appellant, Christopher Cardenas. I'm going to be splitting time today with Oscar Pena, counsel for co-appellant Ruben Cabrera-Sosueto. With this case, the court has the opportunity to clarify the requirements of the federal kidnapping statute and set forth which elements a jury must find beyond a reasonable doubt in order to find guilt. Of the four issues presented in brief, today I only plan to focus on one, and that is the erroneous jury charge as to the willful transportation element. Under the federal kidnapping statute, in order to be guilty, a defendant must, in addition to holding and detaining a victim, also willfully transport that victim, or at least have the intent to willfully transport that victim somewhere.
Is there a dispute that is a requirement? I thought what's in dispute is whether or not the jury was correctly charged through various ways in which it was charged. But I don't think there's a dispute that willfully transport is a requirement.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. It's not in dispute. However, the judge in his instruction cited United States versus Jackson for the proposition that perhaps it was not a requirement of the federal kidnapping statute. And when he was asked specifically three times by Mr. Pena in objections to which we joined, he stated when he was asked to instruct the jury on the specific intent to willfully transport, he stated, I don't think that's what the law is.
Well, wasn't the trial court, the district court, discussing the requirement of interstate or international transportation, whereas you don't need to know where the person is going, which is different, do you have intent to willfully transport?
In responding to the objections, the judge did state that that was his understanding, that you don't need the requirement to travel in interstate commerce. However, at the close of his instruction, when asked, do you need the specific intent to willfully transport anywhere, somewhere, and this is at 1095 of the record, he stated, I don't think that's what the law is.
But didn't he charge them under the pattern jury charge, which does state that it is an element?
Your Honor, he did begin his instruction with the pattern charge, but then he went on to explain those elements.
But he did state the element correctly at some point during the charge. At least two occasions he stated it correctly, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct, that he did state that requirement. However, and our contention is not that he didn't begin his instruction by reading the charge as it is written. However, he did go on to explain that he didn't believe that willful transportation was an essential element. He also stated that there's no dispute that Solis was, in fact, willfully transported. Then he went on to instruct under the aiding and abetting portion of instruction that in order to be guilty, the defendants just needed to participate in a scheme to detain and hold Solis against his will, and that's not what the law requires. It requires not only a holding and detaining of Solis, but also a willful transportation. So yes, Your Honor, it's correct that he did begin his instruction on the right path, but then he completely undermined that instruction with his explanation of what each element meant. Now, in his kidnapping instruction, to go through the instruction as a whole, after reading the essential elements.
Okay, but what about the part where he says it's clear that the defendants didn't move the victim themselves, but the question is whether they were part of a plan to do that. And isn't that the essence? I mean, nobody's saying that your clients were the ones that actually did the transporting. They're saying they were part of the plan to do it. And that's what he says.
Your Honor, it's not just having sort of passive knowledge that a person's going to be moved or even some slight understanding, which were his exact words. You have to understand or you have to have this ultimate idea that a person's going to be moved. You actually have to have the specific intent. Your actions have to be geared towards that ultimate transportation.
But the question is whether they were part of the plan to do that. I mean, if you're just standing around in the pool house or whatever and somebody gets transported, maybe not.
Right.
But you take some step beyond that, you're part of the plan. I mean, isn't that enough?
Well, Your Honor, yes, you do need to be part of the plan, but you also need to have that actual intent to transport. And our contention is that the judge...
Oh, you need to be part of the plan to intend to transport. You don't have to plan to get in the car and drive to Mexico or whatnot yourself, but you're part of the plan. And what is wrong with the judge saying that?
Because
were they part of a conspiracy to do that, or did they assist in some way?
Your Honor, there's nothing wrong with the judge saying that. We're stating that the judge needed to state something more, and that is tell the jury that you need to find these particular elements. One, that they participated in a plan to hold. One, they participated in a plan to detain or seize or inveigle or combine. And three, that they also participated in a plan to transport, and that they had the specific intent when doing these actions to actually transport the victim.
What case law supports your theory that when the judge says gives the correct charge, but then also gives elements of the charge that are not there or that are misleading, that would say that you would get a new trial?
Your Honor, several cases. One being U.S. versus Pompa, which states out the standard for how you look at a jury instruction.
Look at them in the totality. If you look at it in the totality, you could check off that the correct instructions were given in the totality of this charge. So I don't know that case supports your view that if you give some correct information and some that could be misconstrued, that you win.
Yes, Your Honor. In the United States Supreme Court of U.S. versus Nieder, they discuss whether or not an element is not instructed at all or whether or not it's simply misinstructed if there's not clarity with regard to the element. In that case, the court sets forth that if this happens, then that is an error. They go on to discuss the harmless error test and how that would affect a jury instruction in that case. But the discussion on whether or not a jury charge clearly or properly instructs the jury as a whole isn't, and if it does not, because it misdirects the jury on a particular issue, then that is an error that can warrant reversal.
But again, you have to look at the totality, and it seems to me that the judge is continually saying they have to understand the person was going to be taken away somewhere, the dispute or the difference being they didn't necessarily have to know it was Mexico. It could have been from... Dallas to Fort Worth would have been enough for the purpose of willful transportation, not for purposes of federal jurisdiction. And that's where this whole dichotomy between what is jurisdictional, that they did have to actually cross a state line or a country line, versus the transportation element that you're concerned about.
Right.
I mean, you agree they didn't have to know he was going to Oklahoma or Mexico or something like that. It's enough that he's being transported from one city to another or one place to another against his will.
Yeah, absolutely, Your Honor.
And I think the judge is very clear on that when he says they did have to understand that this person was being kept there and restrained, and then he was being taken away somewhere to be taken away against his will. Now, why is that not clear?
Well, Your Honor, that particular portion may be somewhat clear, but then the judge goes on to say, but they're guilty if they just participate in a scheme to detain. And actually, participating in a scheme to detain is participation in a scheme to transport. And that undermines that. And then he also says, there's no question Solis was willfully transported. And that is the intent that we're saying is missing from this charge. If the judge is telling the jury repeatedly that the element has already been satisfied because Solis was willfully transported, and he's going on to tell the jury that you're guilty because the crux of kidnapping is just holding and detaining. If these people participated in the scheme to hold and detain, then he is, in fact, guilty. Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. Are there any further questions?
Counsel, let me ask. Your client was charged also with aiding and abetting kidnapping.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Is it your position that when so charged, he has to be proven to have had all of the same intents that the kidnapping charge itself required, or could he only be involved with aiding and abetting one aspect?
Your Honor, it is our position that he only has to participate in some actions, but he still has to share the principal's intent.
Okay, what is your case that says the aider and abetter has to participate in all of the same criminal intents that the kidnapper would?
Your Honor, it is a Fifth Circuit case. I do not have it on me. I will come back on rebuttal and give you that case.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It please the court. My name is Oscar Pena from Laredo, Texas. The case against the principal defendant in the case, Obregón, was materially different from the case presented against Cabrera. It was different in the sense that while Obregón was in a position where he could make decisions and dictate to Quique and Coqui and Opie and William and some of those people what to do and what not to do, Cabrera was just a person, a visitor, so to speak, who used to go there occasionally to party. He knew that they had free drink, free food, and that's why he was there. But there's absolutely nothing in the record to show that Cabrera had any decision-making authority, or that he encouraged what took place, or that he had any power to stop it, or even that he participated in it. The government tries to bring him into the case by saying that he was doing security because of the place where he was sitting. Cabrera found a place to sit that happened to be close to the entrance, and he took a seat there, some distance away from where they had Solis on his knees questioning him. As the situation developed, there really was no need at all for anyone to guard Solis to keep him from leaving. He had the three or four people with guns surrounding him. Cabrera was not needed as a security guard. When they speak to him as being there for security, that's a conclusion on somebody's part. It is not actually what we had in the case.
He was not needed as a security guard. Doesn't the record reflect that he was standing blocking the door with an AK-15 rifle, an AR-15 rifle, excuse me?
The evidence, as I recall, said that he had picked up a pistol sometime somewhere along the way, because there were rumors that a fellow named Opie had been shot, and Opie was coming over, and they were afraid that Opie would be followed there to the house by the people that were after him. And so everybody picked up arms that were there in the house.
Well, may I ask you again, does the evidence reflect that he stood there and blocked the door with a rifle?
The evidence showed that he was sitting close to the door with a pistol.
A pistol?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I thought he gave his 9mm and took, but regardless, he was standing next to the door with a weapon.
Sometimes sitting down, sometimes standing up, and then eventually he was seen outside in the pool area while the commotion was going on inside of the house. So it doesn't seem like the security guard label applies to him, because if he's really doing security, what is he doing out by the pool when all of that is going out inside of the house? It just doesn't make sense. Plus, there's the fact, like I said, that there was enough people there surrounding Solis, the victim, to where they didn't need somebody at the door to keep him in there. Plus, there was an iron gate, a jail-type gate that could have been closed if they really wanted to keep people from going in and out. That was not done. So, as far as...
Counsel, you haven't appealed the jury charge issue, have you, sir?
I'm sorry, ma'am, I did not...
You did not appeal the charge issue on behalf of your client, did you, sir?
We took the appeal as to all three counts, ma'am.
But on sufficiency, not on the erroneous charge.
Sufficiency of evidence, yes, ma'am. Plus, we also complained of some evidence that we felt was improperly allowed, such as the pawning of the jewelry, because that's another thing that the government used to try to connect him to the offense. They say, well, he took some jewelry and pawned it, and they presented that in such a way as to make it look like he had stolen it, which wasn't true. The pawning of the taking of the jewelry from the victim came after the decision to take him across had been made. It came at the tail end, and the evidence clearly shows that the jewelry was not stolen at all from anybody, and it didn't belong to the victim, it belonged to Obregón. The government also says that this came about because they wanted to punish the victim for the loss of the marijuana. That is incorrect. Nobody there cared about the marijuana. William himself, the victim, stated that this was just an excuse to get him out of the picture. What we really had was three people, the victim, Kike, and Opie, all maneuvering for a position to get into place where they could take money from Obregón. Obregón had sustained a serious head injury sometime in the past. He had collected some $5 million in damages, and the Adriano people, Quique's people, who was actually the one that in charge of the whole thing, Quique's people had already taken from Obregón some $400,000, and they were positioning themselves to take more. And that's what it was about. Quique was trying to get William out of the way. He was trying to get Opie out of the way. All three of them had the signs on Obregón's money. Thank you.
May it please the court. Eileen Wilson on behalf of the United States. The district court did not err in charging the jury, and there's a plethora of evidence to uphold its verdict. As this court pointed out, the jury instructions are legally correct. A couple days ago, I filed a Rule 28J in this case in the Obregón opinion. It's an unpublished opinion, so of course it's not precedent. However, it's compellingly persuasive. And I think what the Obregón opinion does is illustrate we have the same people, the same place, the same victim, the same intent, the same knowledge, and it also illustrates the simplicity of the disposition of this case. The court in Obregón upheld the convictions on all three counts. And what's relevant here simply is this court, obviously a different panel, repeatedly referenced the group and the co-conspirators, which should have included, or in the government's opinion, of course, did include Cabrera and Cardenas. They found that there was plentiful evidence that the group had knowledge and intent, that they promoted the aims of the group, facilitated the objectives of the group, tried to conceal the group's activity, and that the group undertook specific actions.
Well, but to be fair, Obregón was kind of the big guy in all of this.
Absolutely. And the jury, as Judge Kazin told them, had to make their decision based on each defendant and the sufficiency
of each
defendant.
Right. So, saying the group in an opinion that's dealing with Obregón is not intended to bind us, even
absolutely,
published or unpublished.
And that's why I said it's compellingly persuasive and illustrates.
Well, I don't know how compellingly persuasive it is. It is on Obregón, but we're not questioning, they're not really questioning Obregón being the big guy directing everybody in this case, in our appeal.
No, just that there was a group in operation and co-conspirators.
And I don't think anybody's doubting that there was a group in operation. I mean, the man was held in gunpoint and questioned and beaten and all this kind of stuff. The question is, did these two defendants know he was going to be willfully transported against his will? And were they properly instructed on it? That seems to be their focus, and they've got other issues, but that's their focus.
Right, and of course, our contention is that Judge Kazin properly charged the jury. We laid out the pertinent instructions in the brief, and some of them can be found at 1457, 1460 through 1463. Judge Kazin explained to the jury in detail the various elements of each offense. And as the other side agrees, he even referenced willful transportation. The federal jurisdiction part, as I believe we agree on, happens when you crossed into Mexico, and that didn't need to be proved. What we needed was the intent to willfully transport, or the willful transportation. And the evidence in this case showed that.
Is it the government's position that the entire charge was correct in every respect?
Yes. Yes, we believe that
you
Judge...
You do not concede that at times the court stated some things about kidnapping which did not include willful transportation, which could have been seen as the transportation was not an element.
I believe that...
The entire, there were not portions of the charge. If you just take them in isolation, that appear to say that kidnapping just means detention and not willful transportation.
Well, but the inquiry always has to be as a whole, and we're not supposed to, as the reviewing court as well as us, we're not supposed to take artificial isolation. Instead, we have to look at the entire charge, and the entire charge holds up under the pattern jury charges, or under this court's of the Fifth Circuit pattern jury charges.
Do you recognize that the jury was confused on this issue?
And they
asked why they had questions during the deliberation process, and they had to recharge the jury in part.
Absolutely, and the judge asked the counsel whether they had any thoughts. My recollection of the record is the government said no, and nobody else responded. And I believe, in the recharge, he mentioned willful transportation as well. But even if this court were to conclude that there was some error in the charge, which of course our contention is that it's not, it would be harmless in relation to Cardenas, who's the only person that has raised that here, because in his closing argument, he made various references illustrating his defense, none of which was this willful transportation element. And one thing that's very important for this court to remember is repeatedly Kika talked about taking William, Solis, whatever you want to call him, to the other side.
Is there any evidence in the record that Mr. Cardenas heard this? In fact, I think there's some evidence in the record that people standing next to Kiko did not hear, so the inference is that Mr. Cardenas was farther away, so he couldn't have heard. Is there any evidence in the record that Mr. Cardenas heard of any plan to transport William?
He was right there when Kika was yelling and saying it. I believe Cardenas demanded that William tell the truth.
Where in the record does it establish that Mr. Cardenas was present when Kika was saying about the transportation, was discussing the transportation, such that the jury could infer that he overheard or knew of this?
I don't have the record cite with me. However, it is in our brief, and it was mentioned on several.
It was in your brief without a cite, and then the other side's disputed it. And I've gone through the record, and I'm trying to locate the portion.
Well, I think the inference is they're all standing around him, surrounding him. Cardenas is one of the people who's
he's standing there beating him with the rifle.
Yes,
right?
And Kika is right next to him doing the same thing.
But that was at a different time when they were discussing the plan, according to some of the other testimony. That is a different temporal, that occurred after the, it's a different time as this was unfolding that he was telling him of the plan, according to the record. So I'm asking you, where in the record does it support your position that he did hear, or that the jury could even infer that's because someone else who was standing there with him heard, he heard?
Well, let me try to answer it this way, I'm not entirely sure I understand the court's question. Because
the question is, where in the record could the jury infer that there been willful transportation as to Mr. Cardenas?
For one thing, that he heard it was, that William and Opie were getting ready to fight. They had taken a stance. And Kika, now remember, Cardenas is surrounded there. They're all brandishing the weapons, and Kika's announcing that he's going to take William to the other side. That's the first time it's announced. Then when Kika emerges from the bedroom, and
do you have any sites for any of this?
I could supply them. Would you like me to do it in a 28J follow-up? Would that work?
Yes.
Okay. And when Kika emerged from the bedroom, he raised William up and said that he had gotten the green light for William to be taken to the other side. And he also announced again he was taking him to the other side and to kill him. And in conjunction with all of this, Cardenas is not only brandishing his weapon and hitting William, but he's also, at times I recall that him saying that he needs to tell the truth, that William needs to tell the truth about what is happening. So there's a plethora of evidence that William was going to the other side, the intent was to take him to the other side at one point, and then of course he was going to the other side. And Cabrera and Cardenas were in the thick of this. As I said, that Cardenas was armed with the rifle when William arrived. He pointed it at him. He hit him. I don't believe there's any dispute that he hit him several times. He forced William to hand over the jewelry, and I think Martinez says something a little bit different. And Martinez is, who's also known as El Moreno, the Dark One, Ram, Santos, because obviously
everybody has about four names
thing. I have a key for it here. And his testimony is a little bit inconsistent in the jewelry and perhaps even a couple of other things, but of course that's the province of the jury. It's the jury's province to sort that type of thing out. And this court, of course, isn't to reweigh the evidence, but to see whether it supports it.
Let me ask you about this intent, because it seems like the defendants are kind of parsing this very finely, at least Cardenas is, because he's saying, yeah, you got me on assault. I'm standing there beating the guy up with a rifle, or at least there's plenty of evidence about that. And so even if I, like, hear about a plan, does that mean I had the intent to be part of the plan? Just because I'm beating on the guy with a rifle, maybe I just don't like the guy, that doesn't mean I'm part of the kidnapping plan. So they're parsing the intent kind of finely, which is fair. I mean, the defendant, they can do that. And I'm asking you, how far into this intent world, I mean, how far does he have to go? What intent does he have to be part of the kidnapping versus just part of the so-called simple assault?
Well, and that's where the other side gets into the Berry factors, which, of course, we think are irrelevant. This is the Berry situation involved temporary detention, and the courts were sort of focusing on the state penal statutes. But here, and I don't know that this was discussed very much, but we had a roughly 3 to 4 hour time period here. It's undisputed that Kika contacted William roughly around 10 o'clock in the evening. They went to the pool house. At some point, Obregon arrives. Then he leaves to go get Opie. And Deborah, I think her name's Deborah Gomez, the girlfriend, she testifies that Mario arrives after midnight, about 12:30. He's banging on the doorbell. Then they go back over to the pool house. And, of course, we know that Opie is inside the pool house for roughly 45 minutes or something like that. So more time has gone by. And then we have a special agent with ICE testifying on page 929 through 30 that the car crossed the International Bridge into Mexico at 2:15. So approximately 4 hours. That goes way beyond a simple assault.
Well, but I think, and maybe I'm misstating it, as I understand their argument, they're parsing this intent fairly finely. They're saying, you know, this guy's involved in something bad. Okay, he's not just an innocent partier, as they're trying to say about Cabrera. He's involved in the assault. We agree with that. They're saying, where is the evidence that he formed an intent to be part of the plan to willfully transport him? Not just to be there beating up on the guy.
I understand.
But to transport him. And that's, again, it's a parsing, but I think that's fair for the defendants to raise. And I'm asking you, what are the parameters of the intent that you had to show?
Well, when Kika announces that he's going to take him to the other side, nobody backs off. They're still part of it. They're still brandishing, they're still surrounding, and at times they're
so
hitting.
If he keeps beating on him, once he knows that that's Kika's intent, then that's
right.
Enough to show his intent to be part of that plan.
And he's part of
that's
that
your
group, and he
contention.
Intends to form that group. And in fact, at one point when Kika asks Mario, who do you choose, us or William, it's clear that they're acting as a group. They're friends, nobody leaves, nobody tries to leave. And again, the time period here is extensive, 3 to 4 hours roughly, closer to four probably, because it is Laredo.
So, okay, so your point is if he had just been there to, quote, just assault him, and again, I'm not making light of the assault, but I'm just airing the issues here. If he had just been there to assault him, then as soon as he hears this thing about the other side, he should go, whoa, wait a minute, I'm out of here and leave. And then that would have been okay, then he's just on simple assault?
Well, I think the court has to look at all of the facts. Remember, we're in a pool house. This is not some huge...
Okay, I understand that, but I'm asking you, because you're saying that once he hears Kika say that and stays, then that means he's part of the intent. And I'm saying that there has to be an opportunity for him to not be part of the plan. Otherwise, your argument doesn't hold water. So
right.
How
well,
would he not be part of the plan?
Obviously, a mere presence wouldn't suffice. If he picked up his gun or left the gun or whatever and left, that would be part. He would be disassociating with himself. But instead, and I assume we're talking about Cardenas here,
yeah.
Simply because he's the one that's raised the jury type instruction and all that, but the same would apply to Cabrera. They still continue to operate as a group. They continue to associate with the venture. They know there's going to be this transportation. They willfully subscribe to it. I think it's preposterous that he could not have heard what was going on. Clearly, the situation was out of control. We're in a very small venue. It's a pool house. They're surrounding them. Kika is clearly out of control. I don't think anybody would dispute that. And yet they all pin their hopes and dreams onto him. Nobody tries to, because they all want to curry favor with Mario or they want to be his friend. And probably in large portion is because Mario's a rich guy as a result of his medical malpractice award. And so there are a lot of factors that go into this. And these people are friends, remember, coming in. You know, there may be different relationships or different degrees
of
relationships.
Okay, but I mean, my point was simply, what does he have to do to disavow that? Because there has to be an opportunity for him to disavow
Absolutely.
It. Otherwise, it is a mere presence.
He could have left. He could have tried to stop it. He could have done something. And they did nothing. And instead, they completely were in place with them. Where they stopped short was when they left in the car, when Kika and the other one, not Koki, but yeah, Koki, Kika and Koki. Is that right? Yes. Not Kika.
Well, other people went in the car with Cerise, and they didn't go in the car, but they weren't asked to go in the car. I mean,
no, but they didn't try. They didn't do anything, but they knew they were going. They never stopped. They stayed there. There's some conflicting testimony, as I recall, about who helped mop up the situation, but Cabrera continued to guard the place.
There's some evidence he guarded the carpeting or something like that.
Yes, well.
While Obregon cleaned up.
Yeah, well, there's something about Ram helping and whatnot. But the point is, they stayed there. They moved as a group. Everybody, their actions and what they were saying was a full subscription to the conspiracy as well as the aiding and abetting. Did that answer your question, Judge?
Well, I mean, I think the simple point is your argument is he didn't disavow. He could have. Had he disavowed, he'd be all right.
Right. Well, I don't know that he'd be all right.
He'd be all right on a you're not going to go and charge somebody with assault, are you, as a federal prosecutor?
What do you mean we're not going to charge him with assault?
If all he did was beat somebody up, that's a state crime.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't have federal jurisdiction over every person who beats somebody up, or we're going
to
be awfully busy.
Right.
Okay.
No, absolutely, you have to have the federal jurisdiction. Of course, that's where the interstate commerce and all that comes in. So, in any event, and I also think, in response to Mr. Pena, that Cabrera was certainly a willing participant. He was guarding the exit. He switched arms with the Kika when they went into Mexico, and there were other things.
What about Mr. Pena's point that he went out to the pool and he was just partying with the girls and whatnot?
That was after the they got the girls after William was taken over to Mexico, and Ramirez testified that when Kika put the gun in William's mouth, that's when Ramirez said, "I'm going outside for a while." And he said about 10 minutes later he saw Cabrera, which Cabrera then said that there had been some type of confession about William or whatnot. So, I don't agree that he had been out there the whole time. There was testimony that he was sitting by the door, standing, whatever, brandishing the weapon, making sure that he couldn't leave. So he was an active participant. And obviously it's eclipsed when he switches guns for the shooting that's about to come. So clearly he's not an innocent bystander as well. In relation to the evidentiary issues, the government's contention is even if they had been adequately briefed, there's no error, and certainly the error wasn't harmful. And unless the court has any questions, we suggest that the court uphold the jury's verdict.
Thank you.
Judge DeMoss, in order to answer your earlier questions, United States versus Lindell. It's a Fifth Circuit case from 1989 that held that lists the elements of aiding and abetting.
Can you pull the microphone closer?
Excuse me. Yes, Your Honor. It's United States versus Lindell that lists the elements of aiding and abetting and the specific requirement that you must share the principal's intent. It's a Fifth Circuit case from 1989.
And what was the base crime in that case?
It was. Oh, excuse me, Your Honor, I don't have that on me. I just know that the crux of the case was what were the elements of aiding and abetting. In addition to that, other circuits have similarly found. For example, the Eighth Circuit found that same logic in United States versus Roan Engel in 1999 as well. As to the government's contention that Cardenas, that it seems to be the government's position that Cardenas could have disavowed himself from this by while he's standing in a room full of men holding AK-47s and Mini-15s and AR-15s by simply walking away as if that was an option at that point. It appears that Cardenas walked into a situation. He's there to party like he is every other weekend. The men come over. There's a confrontation about who's been lying about a rumor about someone wanting to shoot somebody else. They bring in Opie, and at that point, Opie and Solis get into
a conflict.
So did
he put on a defense of duress? Did he say he was under compulsion to start beating on Solis and all of this, and he himself wasn't permitted to leave?
No, Your Honor. And that's not the position.
Okay, so all this thing about there's all these men standing around, I mean, he still could have easily walked out to the pool and said, man, I'm going to go party, and left. I mean, he doesn't have to make a big stand, I agree, but he didn't do anything to dissociate himself. In fact, he continued beating on him and participating in the crime.
That's not correct, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record that shows that after the announcement was made that Cardenas actually participated further in the crime. In fact, the record shows just the opposite. And the sites that you were looking for, Judge Elrod, at 158 through 159 of the record, this is all during Solis' testimony, as well as 160 and 120 of the record. I'm out of time. Would you like me to finish?
You may answer the question.
Solis testifies that Kike and Obregon were the planners of the assault, and that he had no knowledge of Cardenas having anything to do with the planning of the transportation.
I've allowed the government to submit a 28J with their record sites, and you may do the same if you choose.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Copeland, for your service to the court. I note that you're court appointed. This case is submitted.
We have.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize to you, Mr. Pena.
During the trial, one of the government witnesses said something that I thought was of great interest, at least to me. I'm referring to Agent Rudick, FBI Agent Rudick, who talked about how Cabrera turned himself in, how he answered all of the questions propounded to him. And one of the things that Cabrera related was that after Solis had been carried away by Kike and Coquis, after he had been carried away, Ortegon asked Cabrera to try to reach Kike by phone and to tell him not to harm Solis. At that point, Cabrera told Obregon, look, I'm not going to get involved in something that is not that does not concern me, that does not pertain to me. And I think that tells a lot about his stand and attitude in all of this. He simply wasn't going to get involved. Now, he never threatened, he never hit, he never did anything, he never encouraged anybody to do anything to the victim, and he certainly never did anything to the victim. There was some confusion during the trial because of the similarity of the nicknames of some of the parties. Kike was the one who was in charge of the interrogation, in charge of the whole show, and his name is Enrique Adriano. Then there was his roommate, Coquis, who was Rogelio Garcia, and Kike and Coquis are the ones who took the victim across the river into Mexico. Now, Kiko is Cabrera, so we have Kike, Coquis, and Kiko. Kiko hardly did anything at all. There has been talk about that he handed a gun to Kike. Well, the gun belonged to Kike. It would have been foolhardy for him to say, well, you're asking me to give you your gun, but I'm not going to hand it to you, especially when Kike was holding an AK-47. William testified that that particular pistol, William was the victim, William Solis, testified that the pistol that he was shot with was the pistol that belonged to Kike. And if Kike asked Cabrera for the gun, Cabrera had no choice but to turn it over. Thank you.
Thank you very much.